Mr. Sherwood, Reel 5. We're talking about when you joined the 91st Heavy Anti-Aircraft Regiment, probably at Cleethorpes, but not, you know, in various places in the UK for about 4 or 5 months. And I wonder, you don't know which battery you were in without checking. They can check in the diaries, but you're not sure.
I'm not sure. One of the numbers, three-figure numbers, come to mind, but I'm not 100% sure.
And what about... you joined, what was the job you were given, and gun position officer, it says on your notes.
Yes, gun position officer, but for quite a while we weren't really on an active site. I think it was basically a sort of still continuous training unit, because I know we were in Cleethorpes, I know we were in Harlow, I know we went up to Scotland. We were somewhere in Scotland because we were on some sort of exercise and sleeping in the open every night. We were by Loch Lomond, and foolishly, I went to sleep in my whatever it was on the ground, but in line with the contours. So the difference that I not realizing I'd rolled down towards the lake. And I woke up when I was quite a distance from where I'd started, because I was sleeping up, in line with the contours instead of at right angles to the contours.
Now, what sort of exercise were you doing in the Loch Lomond?
I thought basically map reading type of exercises, given a point to get to, and how to work it, to work out how to copy using compasses and that type of thing. We're also involved in on gun sites, learning drills, different types of drill.
What do you mean?
The method of engaging enemy aircraft. A drill would mean what you do. At the moment, there's a plane, meaning an aircraft coming. You don't know whether it's friendly or foe. And then what you have to do, get the crews onto the guns, get the equipment all lined up and all that sort of thing, ready to decide whether you engage, or to identify the aircraft, and then how you go about engaging it. Because it has to be done stage by stage, they have shell routine. You can't have people waiting for it. Should I put the shell in which now? It's all going to be not according to a strict procedure, and quite fast. The question of identification of aircraft was rather interesting because we had radar. Our radar was in advance, I understand, of the German radar for quite some time, in fact, all the way through. And we had a system that was called IFF. IFF was Identification Friend or Foe. It was quite a secret one at the time, but the idea was it was installed in the aircraft, and if it was caught by the radar, it would give a signal which would come back and be recognized by the radar equipment on the ground as being a friendly aircraft. But sometimes, of course, the pilot forgot to switch it on. And then you had to try to identify the aircraft. It wasn't that easy. We did have quite a few lectures on identification of aircraft. But it was very difficult to distinguish between an enemy runner, German Messerschmitt, and say, a Spitfire or a Hurricane. They were very much the same, particularly depending on the angle. You knew that, say, the Spitfire that you once had a little cutout where the wing joined the fuselage, but you often just couldn't see it. And the officer, the gun position officer, he was the one who had to decide whether it was friendly or not. Sometimes, I remember on one occasion, the spotter, as we called it, the spotter in the gun position area, to identify it. And he said, oh, it's friendly, and I said, no, it's not, it's a message or something. I can't remember which one of us was right, but the sounds of actually hitting it with the gunfire was very remote.
Now, what can you run through your role as gun position officer on the gun position? Yeah. How was the gun position set up, first of all?
Right. Each battery would have three sections. Originally, not three, but before it was only four, but then it changed over to threes. And you'd have three sections in the battery, and each section would have three guns. You'd have, when you're actually in action, you'd have the central part where the gun position officer was, and generally speaking, when you did it, it sort of dug a little hole in the ground, depending how mobile you are, how much time you have. You take from a 3-ton lorry the cowling, the frame that held the canvas on top of it, stick that in the ground, so that's the protection from the rain and whatever. In that you had plotting mats and things like that. Outside you had a line which contained in the middle the gun position officer himself with his binoculars, a spotter who had a particular type of magnifying telescope to try to identify. You had the range finder, which was this long sandwich for taking the pull for the where the mirrors had to be moved to identify the range, more or less. And then you had the predictor, which is a square cube, a box with all the secret, whatever was inside, very, very complicated and all that. Then you had, at a distance of maybe 20, 30 yards, the guns like that. Each gun was, if you had to go into action quickly, you just put it down where you were, and that's all. But if you had time, you'd build some sort of a trench so the guns would be a bit lower and more protected, and if possible, it's got earthwork or sandbags around it for protection. It depended entirely on the situation, what you did. Sometimes entirely in the open, if you're on a static position, where it's been for 6 months or the guns were static, it was all made concrete and all that sort of thing. But we weren't there, we were mobile. And I remember being mobile was considered to be the more honourable thing to be. And I remember when I was told that I was going to go onto a mobile anti-aircraft, and I thought, oh, good. That's a question, not a good thing or bad.
Now, in what way were they mobile? I mean,
static guns, which are static, they were fixed in cement and fixed solid, and they were just there. Mobile could travel, had wheels.
So they'd be towed by a truck or?
Gun towing vehicle, which was the Leyland bus chassis. The same shape as the double-decker bus is now. They were Leyland at the time. Very powerful, the diesel engine. That would be the gun towing vehicle. That also carried ammunition and carried gun crew, there were 10 people. Very powerful. That weighed about 10 tons. The gun itself, which was towed behind, would weigh also about 10 tons. We have a 20 ton load. And whenever I had the opportunity, I had to take over driving one of these. And they were magnificent. The power in anything, when you put your foot on the accelerator and you felt the surge, it was wonderful. And I used to drive quite frequently. I shouldn't, really, technically I shouldn't, but I took over it long ago. And also I became a bit expert in writing, gun towing vehicles which had toppled over. So you're going through the sand in the desert, sometimes...
I'll come there, because that's a little later. Yes. Now, what about... what did you actually do as gun position officer?
Yeah, you controlled the chute. Assuming that you identified it was an enemy plane, kind of a precise wording, but there was a series of words that people said which all built up to the point where you said fire. You had to, engage the... predictor people were the operator, that's the basic central thing. They would search for the plane. They would be given an indication either by radar of the bearing and or by the spotter who saw it, and on his device there would be a bearing, and so they would have a rough idea where to go and a rough sort of elevation, so they had telescopes one on each side. And as the predictor would traverse, it would go in line with the direction of the plane, and the telescopes on either side would then try to get on to the, so that they could see the plane visually. For those days, it was almost entirely visual engagement. And one of them got on, the person on the bearing plane was bearing on, meaning that he's got the plane in his sights, and then the chap on the other side, when you get the right elevation, would say elevation on. So you knew that the predictor was then following the path of the plane. As soon as they were on, it would take a little time before the predictor could work out what sort of fuse to set. And then as soon as the person who was doing that would say, set fuse 8, and that would be shouted down to the ground crews. And they were set manually to fuse 8. You always had to do it a bit ahead, so you had time for very things to happen in the meantime.
And that was shouted, it wasn't done by phone or anything?
That was shouted. But you had electric communication between the predictor and each gun. So that as the predictor itself moved around, so a dial on the gun, where the one side was the bearing, the other side was the elevation, a dial would move. And the person who was controlling the movement of the gun itself manually would follow the movement of that electrical gun. And so in principle, the guns were pointing in exactly the same position as the predictor was pointing. The predictor would be working out a position a certain distance ahead, depending on the range and the length of time it would take before the fuse would explode. There was all that other complicated calculation that had to be made. It was up to the gun position officer to decide the moment at which to fire. And he would call out, there was a sergeant nearby with a megaphone, and he would call out, fire. And then the chap would call out, fire, and those guns would start firing and carry on firing as rapidly as they could until you got the word cease fire. When the officer decided there was no purpose of shooting anymore, the planes had gone away or possibly been destroyed, so they didn't like it, but possibly, you call out cease fire. You had to be a bit careful because there was a difference between cease fire and cease firing. I don't know why they made it so, the words the same, but cease firing meant right, up sticks, we're on the road, we're moving away. Cease fire just meant stop firing for the moment. Also, for some reason, somebody at one point yelled out four something, and they couldn't be fire. And everybody started firing. And if one gun position started firing, the other gun positions in the area said, oh, we're missing something, we better start shooting, put up a barrage. So some sort of the whole area would be shooting just because somebody made a mistake in
Now, a lot of that shooting at a plane, in the First World War, they'd really set about barrages where they tried to provide a curtain of fire.
Yes. We had barrages. You had, for example, suppose we were with forward airfields. We followed the airfields to defend them. But if you were stationary, probably static, but around the port, you'd have set up harbour barrage. And if you caught, that was all prepared, just where each one was going to fire, and you call out harbour barrage, and then everything would be pointed in our particular position, and you'd be firing there. So theoretically, around the port or whatever.
Now, did you ever get a chance to practice that in England or Scotland?
Not in practice. I don't think it did very much firing, actually, in Britain. Whether that was perhaps a shortage of whatever, or that we were training, but didn't do a great deal of actual firing.
Where you fired at live German aircraft?
In England? No, I don't think so.
Okay. What about your relationship as an officer with your NCOs?
Well, that was always the difficulty of maintaining a balance. You want to be friendly, but not pally. It's very difficult because there's been a changeover in the relationship between officers and men subsequent to the last war. But there was that thing that you had to keep your distance. You could be together, you have parties, you're drinking together, singing together, but there's always that funny thing. An NCO would never call an officer by his first name. It would be Mr. First or Captain First, or Mr. Lieutenant, Captain, otherwise. And, but officers could call sergeants by their first name. If the regimental sergeant major or the battery sergeant major, you would call them Lister. They were very polite to them. Otherwise, you could use the first name. But with gunners, the lowest level, there would probably be no fraternizing at all. Except at Christmas Day, we used to, the officers would serve.
With the other, I mean, did you have a sort of a pastoral role, a welfare role that was
If people had problems, they'd come to the office and it went all the way up. For example, also, this was a quite difficult problem. We used to censor the men's mail. We had to read unsealed, and you read through to check whether they were.
Was that in England or overseas as well, or both?
I think it was in both. But you had to be confidentiality. You never told other people unless it was necessary for military reasons. Oh, so and so got a problem with his wife. But I remember one thing. Probably couldn't have done it, but at some stage. Somebody had written that he'd given the army the best years of his life. It's a long sad in a way, but so true. And also in some of the letters there were sad things, and particularly when you're abroad, we didn't read the letters that were coming in. They would go straight to the person, so when you read the reply, you could only surmise what the original letter sent. Some of the Christmas sad, dear John letters. And it was, there was quite a bit of that. Also, the level of literacy was pretty low, I imagine, by the extent of international. But nevertheless, it was a letter.
Was there ever anything in it that there shouldn't have been?
Maybe if somebody had referred to a particular place, then, say, oh yes, we're here, we're moving up to Brook or to wherever it is. They didn't have the actual, we wouldn't have the address of the regiment to Brook. It would be the Army Post Office, and then the Army Post Office would distribute it to the member. I don't recall. I got in lots of good trouble. It was rather, I thought it was a bit weird. But I sent airmail letters.
I'll come back there because that's later on.
On this case, because it happened just after, I think it was even from the ship. I'm not sure. I sent a letter home and I'd written something in musical script. You know, spelling like one fine day or something or other. I wrote the thing. And my major, who sent it the officer's mail, called me and said, well, you can't let this go. What's this? So I explained it. It's a one-time deck or something, and a butterfly. There's a reason for choosing that butterfly anyway. Just like he said, oh, no, this might be a code. So I had to step it all out.
Now, anything else about your time in the UK? Before you went out?
Each place we went to, it didn't take long before the junior officers found out the place to go to where you could dance and you could get to know local girls. That was always a regular thing, you got to know local girls. We were then in our very early 20s, 20 or so, so basically the girls were 17, 18, 19. And there were always girls around, and we'd pick them out for the meals and for dancing, and there was a lot of petting that went on. I don't think there was much nothing like this. There's people I know, I don't know what it was, but it actually affects. But there was a lot of petting in the, if you were going around by taxi, there would be a lot of petting. And the girl didn't seem to mind, and but it, at the end of it, and when you moved off, sometimes I felt that the girls became more interested in the men from a long-term point of view than the men, than the officers were. We knew we were going to move on, we knew that nothing was going to develop after this friendship. It was a temporary thing, sharp wheel concerned. But often the girls themselves became much more serious. And but then at that sort of age, men were quite callous. They are words of pity, but tough. And she's taking it this seriously, not meant to be serious. And then one would move on. It might be an odd letter or two after the effort, tail off. And it would come to an end. But no question that wherever we were, finding girls was a main part of the entertainment. We didn't find people for life, it was, I suppose, there weren't anything.
Anything else before you left? Because you went out in December 41.
That's right. Then, as I say, we were various places in Liverpool. We thought a couple of three thoughts. Then we went to Wakefield. And Wakefield was another staging post. But when we were in Wakefield, we were already, we knew that we were due for embarkation. That must have been, I suppose, about October, September, October. Due for embarkation, and preparation had already been made leading up to embarkation. We had lectures on the various aspects of going abroad and being abroad and so on. That was Wakefield. I have very pleasant memories of Wakefield. But then finally we moved to Liverpool. Liverpool was the port of embarkation. We expected to embark quite soon.
Did you get embarkation leave?
Well, yes.
Sorry.
Many times. It's coming on. We expected to go abroad to embark probably about in November, early November. But ships were found and we were available, and we went on embarkation. And that became a bit of a farce after a while, because when we go on embarkation leave, say goodbye to our family and all our friends, they go, who knows what, and then 10 days later we're back again. And that happened several times. Leading up to the final thing in the beginning of December, when we go from New Year to New Year. And I remember when my mother, at that time, I think I mentioned, my brother had been reported missing in Crete, and we didn't know what happened to him. I didn't know. And one, I used to, when I stayed with my parents in Bordeaux, I'd go back on Sunday or whenever it was, the leave ended. But on one occasion, I was packing in a different way, and my mother recognized that I was packing differently, and she realized why I was packing, because it was a sign of packing for you at the time, and she was very distraught, because they said, you know, happy to have a mother, and it was like following a big footsteps down the door, and that was really, really sad. And I remember my mother saying, well, when you go there, you must write if you need. And I said, anyway, no money if not right. I'll write whenever I can. But if I say every week and for some reason there's a delay, you'd be very worried, I'll write frequently. I didn't write as frequently as I should, but I did. That was early December. Not a very early December because we had Bart, and I'm looking at the diary again. That started a wonderful experience of my life. And I say a good war, because we embarked on the SS Orchides. The SS Orchides was in effect a luxury liner that was originally built for the South African line. And it had only done one or two runs, but that was all. It watered and it provisioned in South Africa, where there was absolutely no shortage of anything. In England, there was a blackout, rationing, very different thing. On the ship was very comfortable.
What was the accommodation like for officers and men?
This is, I mean, what could have led up to something rather important. We had a cabin for two, came to four. The cabin that was designed for two had excellent the bunks put in, and so there were four of us. But still very, very comfortable. The cabins were fine. All the first class areas, the lounges, the dining rooms, and all that were reserved for the officers. The men went down into the holds, and I'll come back to that in a moment. I shared the cabin with the three other people. I remember the name, Mappet, Ian Galloway, I think it was, but also Charles Fisher. Charles Fisher, the son of the bishop, who later became Archbishop Fisher. And that was rather amusing. Also, it had interesting repercussions when I was in South Africa. I'll come on to that later. We got along very well. It was fantastic. In the restaurant, dining rooms, had menus, all set out nicely. Spoons, fantastic, served by the waiters and the stewards. Alcohol drinks, very good quality drinks, very cheap. And then afterwards, we had them to be in the lounges, various lounges. And also, this was an important thing, the nurses shared the first class accommodation with the officers. The nurses were QAIMM nurses, Queen Alexandra, Imperial, Olympic nurse and something. Generally, they were the nurses of higher grade than normal poor nurses. They were much more superior. They considered themselves much superior, and they were, from a practical and technical point of view, more capable. But of course, they were available for the officers. And it was a long haul, 6-8 weeks, I think, to get through the thing. So there was a lot of affairs developing with the officers and the nurses, and on deck at night, whatever went on. Now, the men were down in the hold. Thousands, I don't know, hundreds of them, sleeping in hammocks at the swarming ground, whatever. Absolutely cramped in terrible conditions. Terrible by our standards. Quite like 100 years ago, the Navy was very, very much worse, but it was terrible. And in fact, and they were only allowed up for a couple of hours every now and then, get fresh air, then down they had to go. We had the run of the deck, so whenever we wanted the swimming pool, we had the different things. So men were allowed to use the swimming pool, maybe some of the NCOs were. But there was a sharp division. And on one occasion, after being at sea for a while, the other commander junior officers, were so hurt by the condition in which the men were living, food was awful and all that, that we went to the major, the battery commander, who was the next in line up, to say, well, this is terrible, surely we can do something about it. And we were told by the major, his name was, to come up from the ranks. He said, you do your duty, the men do their duty, and you don't complain. And there was nothing more we could do. Except we had to go down when we were orderly officers, see about the food, any complaints, and obviously there were complaints, but whether they were, sometimes they were enough, but you had to pretend all well, that was that. And it was very unpleasant. But life on the officers was excellent. It was absolutely super. It was almost like a cruise. Of course, they were risky submarines. We joined convoys, and we lived at convoys, and never knew what's going to happen on submarines.
Were you worried about it? I mean, was that a worry to you?
As I say, with thinking back, I don't think I was worried. I remember at one time seeing the line on the water in foam pointing towards the ship, and I remember thinking, gosh, is that a torpedo? But it wasn't. And I can hardly ever worry. We had those drones, of course, regularly. But I think we worried about the risk of the billions happening. We knew it was happening, but somehow, you know, it happened to the other chap and not to you, that type of thing.